The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
To order. Just before we start, I would like to remind everyone to make sure that your cell phones are either turned off or on vibrate or silent. And with that, I would like to start with the introductions. I'll start with Mr. Ramey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everybody. Gary Ramey, MLA, Lunenburg West.
Graham Steele, Halifax Fairview, sitting in today for the member for Hammonds Plains, Upper Sackville.
Hi, I'm Gary Burrell. I represent Colchester Muscadabit Valley, and I'm here in the place today of the member for Cumberland North.
Jim Woodrow, the MLA for Guy's for Sheet Harbour, and I'm sitting in for the member from Pictou East.
Good morning and welcome. Howard Epstein, MLA for Halifax Chebucto.
Good morning. Kelly Regan, MLA for Bedford Birch Cove, in for the member for Dartmouth East.
Good morning, Chris D'Entremont, and just keeping on with that, I'm in for the member for Inverness.
Janet White, Office of the Auditor General, Audit Principal of the Audit.
Jacques Lapointe, Auditor General.
Darlene Henry, Committee Clerk.
Mark LeBlanc, Executive Director of Health Information Technology, Nova Scotia, and the IT Director for the IWK.
Fern Merlin Smith, Senior Information Advisor, Department of Health, and I was the Director of Information Management Decision Support and IT at the IWK during the Auditor General's work at the IWK.
Anne McGuire, President and CEO of the IWK Health Center.
Good morning, I'm Chris Power. I'm the President and CEO of Capital District Health Authority.
Good morning. I'm Shauna McMahon, the Director of Technology and Infrastructure Renewal at Capital Health. And during the audit, I was the Director of eHealth at Capital Health.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Galton, Vice President, Performance Excellence and General Counsel for Capital Health.
Good morning. I'm Keith Caldwell, President. I'm Keith Caldwell. I'm the Chair of the Committee. And with that, I'd like to probably start with Dr. McGuire to make a presentation.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for inviting us to be here this morning. I'm pleased to be joined by two of my colleagues today, whom you've just met, Fern Marlin Smith and Mark LeBlanc. Fern, as she said, is Security Advisor Information Management with the Department of Health and Wellness. And prior to her recent succumbing to the Department of Health, Fern held the position of Director Information Management, Information Technology, and Decision Support Services at the IWK. And as she mentioned, she did work very closely with the team from the Auditor General's department through the audit. Mark is Executive Director, Health Information Technology Services, or as we refer to it, HITS Nova Scotia, and also collaborated with the audit team in areas related to the HITS Nova Scotia mandate. Most recently, as a result of Fern's secondment, and as we transition to the new Merged Services Nova Scotia structure for IT, Mark assumed a direct IT leadership role for the IWK's IT services. The IWK Health Centre takes the protection of personal health information very seriously, and we are very aware, always, of the trust that each patient family puts in us to keep their information and their children's information private and confidential. We value our participation in this very thorough review and the focus that it brings to the importance of protecting patient information. The IWK has policies, plans, and approaches in place to ensure the security of our patients' information. However, as the Auditor General's review of personal health information systems indicated, the IWK agrees that there is always room to improve and is committed to augmenting current practices. We value and support the Auditor General's review and recommendations to enhance our information technology security and controls. Our information technology and privacy teams consider patient privacy and system security their number one priority. And they have already addressed or are in the process of addressing several of the Auditor General's recommendations. To date, we have implemented 32% of the Auditor General's recommendations, with an additional 40% to be complete in the next 3 to 6 months, and a further 16% within a year. The remaining 12% are ongoing, and some examples of these efforts are as follows. We have made progress in updating our IT disaster recovery plan and will be conducting a structured walkthrough of the plan within the next 6 months. We are very close to moving our Meditech patient information system to the provincial data center, which will allow for the IWK data center to become the secondary center. We have improved our practice related to the consistent documentation of the response and resolution of reported incidents, and we are working with HITS Nova Scotia to implement the new provincial incident and problem management platform, which is targeted for the fall of 2013. We have updated a number of policies related to the access of information and system security and have others in the final stages of approval. We have updated a number of policies related to the access of information and system security and have others in the final stage. The Provincial Privacy Best Practice Committee has developed policies and practices in contemplation of the new FIA legislation, which will allow for consistency of practice across the provincial healthcare system. And we've made significant progress in our efforts to apply fair warning auditing software to our largest and most frequently used patient information system, which is Meditech. The review also highlights the importance of working closely with our provincial partners on strategies related to health information security, including the Department of Health and Wellness, HITS Nova Scotia, and Merged Services Nova Scotia. And further, the introduction of the new Personal Health Information Act, or FIA, presents an excellent opportunity for system-wide collaboration on the implementation of best practices for the protection of personal health information. Of course, as we look to enhancing our information security systems, we will need to carefully consider cost and patient care implications. We need to continually ensure that we are making the wisest investments across our services. Once again, thank you for having us here this morning, and we welcome any questions that you may have for us. Thank you.
Ms. Power.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before your committee and to provide an update on Capital Health's work to address the recommendations the Auditor General made regarding our personal health information systems. As you can appreciate, this is a very complex area of our operations, so I'm really pleased to be joined by two of my colleagues. To my far right, Catherine Galton, who is Capital Health's Vice President for Performance Excellence and our General Counsel, and who provides leadership across Capital Health for patient privacy, as well as Shauna McMahon, our Director of Technology and Infrastructure Renewal. And Shauna was previously the Director of Health Information Services during the period of the audit by the Auditor General. She is now responsible for IT hardware, communications technology, and support services. Capital Health welcomed the review and recommendations of the Auditor General and his staff and collaborated over the course of a year to support this important work. We certainly believe that the recommendations made by the Auditor General will augment the existing information technology control environment at Capital Health. Once again, we'd like to express our sincere appreciation to the Auditor General and his team for their excellent work. Given the scope and depth of the audit, Capital Health would never have been able to fund this type of assessment from our own internal resources. At Capital Health, quality patient care is job number one. We know that our obligation to keep patient information confidential and secure is fundamental to the relationship of trust that is required to provide the best care to our patients and our citizens. We work diligently to protect information and our systems from outside threats. We have confidence in the strong access controls and see the success of these controls in our record of defending against attempts to breach our security. Capital Health uses a technology service that monitors our environment for any external security threats. Over the previous 12 months, we have recorded over 1 million possible threats. None has led to a data loss within our system. As custodians of patient information, we also know that timely and appropriate access to patient information is an essential part of modern quality health care. Like the Auditor General, we recognize that an additional risk to the security of personal health information is an internal one. As an organization, we value integrity and accountability, and we remain confident in the ethical practices of employees throughout our organization. Our ability to do proactive auditing is improving. We are implementing new provincial technology, known as Fair Warning, to automate the auditing function. Our ability to upgrade and back up our systems also depends on funding. Creating electronic redundancy and physical duplication of data and equipment requires major investment. In budget planning, we must weigh the value of these investments and the level of acceptable risk associated with each recommendation. But we're already making progress. In fact, for the past 2 years, we have been working with the Department of Health and Wellness on the relocation of our data center. In the larger context, we are also participating in Merge Services Nova Scotia, which has begun the work of establishing a new governance structure for information technology decision-making across the healthcare sector. Capital Health continues to ensure our critical patient care systems are adequately protected and secured, and we look forward to answering your questions this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Regan, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to start off with Capital Health. A year ago, January 10th, a news article appeared in the Chronicle Herald with a headline which read, "Health Worker Loses Job After Prying Into Patient Files." Now, in the pages of and pages of recommendations offered from the district, what specific actions has Capital Health taken to ensure a headline like this never appears in the paper again?
Ms. Power?
Thank you for that. I'm going to ask Catherine if she'd like to start on answering that question around privacy and what we're doing with it.
Thank you for the question. Capital Health, it's interesting in that case that, of course, it was discovered as a result of some of the systems that are in place in Capital Health, particularly the issue was identified through a staff member. And our ability to actually audit that system, our Horizon patient folder, allowed us to get very specific in relation to what had occurred.
both so that we could take necessary action to follow it up, but also so that we could be very specific with patients when we notified them that it had occurred. We could tell them exactly what sections of their record had been accessed, to what extent, whether it had been printed or just viewed. And so that system is there, and we've built on it. So out of that, we are exploring, as Chris has said, the implementation and soon to be implemented, the application of fair warning to our systems, so that we will have both a, we already have reactive audit as evidenced in that case, and we will also have proactive auditing from the perspective of setting parameters on the system that would trigger that type of review electronically. So that would be the fair warning system. In addition, we have started to run some guided or selected proactive audits. So, for example, we actually audited all of our health information service workers, and you'll remember from the paper that that was the case in January of 2012. So we actually were able to proactively audit all of those employees. Those employees necessarily have the greatest access to health information, and so we thought that was a good place to start. So that, and as both our CEOs have mentioned, the work that is going on around the implementation of FIA has contributed and provided us with a real platform to get the message out again around the importance of confidentiality. It's absolutely fundamental to the trust our patients have in us. And so we have online education in that regard. The online education requires a recommitment to a confidentiality pledge that is signed on employment. So that and many others, but I'll stop there.
So just out of curiosity, so, you know, when you sign on as an employee, do you go through a course? Is there some kind of a program that outlines what to do and what not to do?
Sure. So confidentiality and the importance of it, and actually signing the pledge, is part of an orientation for all staff. Mm-hmm. It's important to remember that while we at Capital Health have a fundamental role in relation to that, we're in the norm dealing with healthcare professionals, mm-hmm. where that is an absolute aspect of their mm-hmm. training. And for many of them, particularly for healthcare professionals, it's an ethical obligation through their professional colleges. So our education definitely supplements that, but together the message is very clear to staff.
Are there refreshers? Let's say you work at the hospital for 20 years, and you know, around the 15-year mark, you might just sort of forget. Is there sure. a regular update?
Sure. So there's an opportunity for regular update, and this is offered. Our privacy officer, for example, does many educations, either directed at groups or general sessions. Always, what we're trying to facilitate through the online system is actually that there is both a course and a recommitment to the confidentiality, and that will be required annually, to be completed annually.
I can certainly say that I worked at the Grace Foundation 20 years ago, and it was drilled into our heads. And, you know, I remember talking with nurses who say, you know, if we run into a friend in the hallway, we don't say, why are you here, even? That was sort of drilled in. Yes. According to that same article that we were just discussing, 14 patients were sent a letter which stated, and I quote, to the best of our knowledge, your employee information has not been disclosed to anyone else by this employee. So I'm just wondering how the district knew that was the case.
So, as I've indicated, in the system that we have, we can tell whether something was printed or faxed somewhere else out of that system. So that's one way. In addition to that point, we had not we would follow up, and so not to get into the particular case so specifically, but in that kind of situation, we would follow up both with the person who is alleged to have breached and within our systems to see whether, in fact, we'd had any complaints or any disclosure in relation to that. So both the electronic and our own follow-up.
So you would go back to the person who was alleged to have leaked the information or to access the information and say, did you tell anybody else?
That would be one aspect of it, yes.
Could Ms. Power give us some indication as to what process is followed by the district when a member of the public believes their personal health records have been inappropriately accessed?
So, Ms. Power.
Thank you. Again, Shauna, perhaps you want to take that, or Catherine, whoever.
I can start. Generally, there would be someone would call and make a concern that they believe something has occurred. Generally, that would go through HR and privacy. They would be involved. They would then coordinate what the collection of data would be. And in some cases, that would mean contacting our security person in our IT department. And he would run audits on either dates or the information that's given. We do not get the name of the individual for confidentiality because you're still in the investigation mode. So generally he would get information on running reports on a particular system for a particular date. It might be on a particular patient, and it could be the Horizon patient folder system. It might also be the STAR registration system, and then it would be given over to HR and privacy. And what they would be looking to do is to see, was that, for example, if it was a patient, were they in that day, and was there a requirement for that healthcare professional to be looking at that particular information? A healthcare professional is only to look at information that they require in the course of treatment of an individual. So that would be a start, and then once all that data was produced, it would go to privacy, and they would then analyze that, and then there'd be a determination if there was a concern, or and then if they have to get human resources in place. We have to be cautious in doing that, because some people may punch in a wrong number, and it would look like they accessed a record, but it was for a couple of seconds. And that would not indicate to us that that was what we would call a breach. If it was someone fishing around for a long period of time, you would see that. And if it wasn't a patient that they were directly involved in, that would then lead to the privacy officer then further exploring that.
Now, am I correct in assuming that cases are more often brought to the attention of Capitol Health, or potential breaches would be more often brought forward by employees rather than patients? Or is it, I was just wondering what the percentage was.
I can't give you a percentage, but I would say I think we're very fortunate that we do not have a high number. In my previous role, I know that I've had a call that was from someone in public who was concerned, and at that call I would then talk to the privacy officer. And sometimes we have some internal, but it's very infrequent.
So how many situations would the district investigate in the run of a year? Let's say for the past 2 years, how many would have been investigated?
Miss Gallant?
Galton, thank you. Just one piece. Our protocol around investigation of privacy breaches is actually published on our website, and it's very much in line with what Shauna has already said to you. It's important to note that throughout the time, the person who is complaining is kept very well informed as to the progress of that investigation. The one piece, and if I can, just on the last, what's very important to know is how strenuous a job it is to truly audit. So an electronic audit that indicates whether a person has access to your record or not is one piece of it. The other piece is then to follow up on what that audit shows. So we have healthcare professionals who necessarily have access to health records. And so the job of determining whether they needed access in a particular case is hugely difficult. So their manager may be the only person who can do that cross-connect between what might be hundreds of patients. So just there. Over the last couple of years, in the last year, we've had seven where we've done a full investigation. Some of those are, as Shauna indicates, accidental breach. So remembering that, you know, if a piece of paper is dropped on the floor and someone picks it up, that constitutes a breach for which we're... So over the last year, we will have seven that we've done really intensive investigations on, not counting the audit that I talked about in relation to health information service staff. So that was huge.
So do you feel the... Oh, sorry.
Ms. Power.
And perhaps just to put that in perspective, we see upwards of 1 million patients a year come through our doors at Capital Health. And that's, you know, if you think about all the patient records we would have in our archives, just put that in perspective for us.
Thank you for that. That does put it in perspective. Do you feel that you have, given the strenuous nature of doing an audit, do you feel you have the staff appropriate to be able to do that kind of thing? Because if you're, am I correct in understanding that it's a nurse manager that begins the audit or begins doing the investigation?
Ms. Galton.
Yes, so the investigate, so the complaint normally comes in and is somehow either is directed to the privacy officer if it doesn't come there initially. The audit, the electronic audit, is actually run, as Shauna has indicated, between the privacy officer and those security mm-hmm. people. If we determine that the person has had access to that particular person's record, it usually then triggers a wider audit to say, well, what other access have they mm-hmm. have they had? And there would then be a review. So it has to be someone who knows the patient population. That might be a health services manager. Mm-hmm. It might be a health information manager. It really depends very much on where the employee who's being complained about, where they work.
So do you feel you have the appropriate staffing to be able to conduct full and complete investigations if, in fact, it is a strenuous job to do a full audit?
There's no question that's a huge resource pull, and yet it's important mm-hmm. enough that that we direct resources to it. So it is huge. Do we have enough? We could definitely use more assistance on that front, but we make it a priority when it occurs. It is just that fundamentally important.
What would a district like Capital Health do if a breach was reported by a staff person and the breach involved the record of another employee as a patient?
The same process is followed. So in that instance, we're not dealing with staff and staff. We're dealing with staff and patient because that is the context in which we have a record for that person.
Okay. Thank you. The district has provided a comprehensive response to the AG's recommendations, the vast majority of which are in progress. Has the district calculated a cost to the district itself to implement all these recommendations? And if yes, how much? And if no, why not?
Ms. Power.
So I'll start that. There is no question that there, you know, when we looked at all of the recommendations, we understood that there would be time and cost involved in that. So I'll ask Shauna to speak a little bit more to the process that they followed. But what I will say is Shauna and her team and others looked at all of the recommendations and prioritized them. And we went from there, recognizing that this work is going to take time, money, and collaboration with the Department of Health and Wellness and many, many others. So we have not quantified what all of those costs would be, but rather are working through the recommendations in order of priority and working closely with the Department of Health and Wellness on that. And Shauna, if you have anything to add.
Thanks,
Ms.
Chris.
I want to get the proper pronunciation of your name. What's
Shauna McMahon.
McMahon, thank you.
Thank you. And it is complex in terms of trying to predict a cost, but I can give you some examples. When we were undergoing the audit, we had already embarked with our colleagues at HITS Nova Scotia on, we had done a vulnerability assessment on our data center a few years ago, and we knew that we had to do some work to update our storage component, and we also wanted to create redundancy between the provincial center and Capital Health. So that particular work just on the data center alone, which is involving us placing all of our backup servers at Yonge Street, and for Capital Health storage it stays at the Abbey J Lane, and for HITS Nova Scotia we're reversing that. We have a 9-10-year lease, and that lease is $20 million. So that just for the storage. We're also working with the province at this time, the bigger province, Education Justice, and they're looking at, based on a previous Auditor General report, on what we call a secondary data center for the province, which would be for redundancy in the case of anything like a hurricane or something like that that might come through and could affect the other data centers. Also, as we bring in new technology, I think it's interesting to note that some of the technology we have started coming on board in healthcare in the 90s, which is a long time ago. And at that time, I remind people that healthcare, even though there's so much in the media about it, it's actually kind of an immature technology field when you look at something like banking. And I date myself, but I worked in a bank in Cape Breton back when they were first putting in the automated bank machines, and nobody wanted to use them, I can tell you that. and now you can go anywhere in the world and get your money. So in healthcare, it's a relatively new burgeoning area. So what we're doing now is each time our applications come up for renewal or upgrade, we go back to the vendor and say, here's what we have in FIA, here's what we need to have for auditing purposes, what's that going to entail, and do you have it? We're fortunate, I guess, in some ways, in that many of the large vendors are international, so they also have to comply with HIPAA in the U.S. So they are updating their processes much more. So when Catherine refers to Horizon Patient Folder is Capital Health scanning and archiving system. It and all the documents that are produced every day are scanned and then archived electronically, and then the paper's destroyed after that. We do 34,000 documents a day, 1 million a month, and that Health Information Services group that Catherine referred to that we audited, that I oversaw that group at that time, and that's why we did the audit. They have access to that information. So we audited to make sure that they were compliant with our policies. So an upgrade for a system, we just did one with the lab system, and that can be, depending on the complexity, it can be $500,000. Some of them can be $300,000. So as we keep updating, that's what we put in place. So we didn't go through and do a full cost of what everything would be. The other thing we know that's happening is, as folks mentioned with merged service, we had already started some projects jointly. So my colleague Mark and our group, one would be a whole a new application for our help desk. So the Auditor General talks about ticketing and how the help desk manages its tickets. So with the new application we're bringing in, we will have all those procedures written and incorporated into this new application. The one we have is older. So as those legacy systems are getting upgraded, we're bringing in and we're jointly sharing the costs of those. So we have a couple of things on the go.
So when you say you're jointly sharing the costs of those, that's Capital Health and IWK. Are you receiving any assistance from the Department of Health and Wellness to purchase this kind of upgrading of IT technology?
In some cases, the province will have purchased a system, and then we would link into that. So an example of that would be the SHARE portal, which is the portal that all of the physicians can access information in the Capital Health system and in the provincial system. And Anne McGuire mentioned about the IWK. There was three core platforms in Nova Scotia, and we're very fortunate. Many provinces have 10, 20 more, and that's why it makes it challenging for them to create a more integrated system. So within Nova Scotia, there's a Meditech platform. The IWK had Meditech Magic, and Capital Health has a mixed, we call it a best of breed platform, which means that we, due to some of the services and special needs at the time when we put those systems in place, that was an acceptable approach, and it means we have different vendors supplying the applications. So we're now
order,
looking
please.
Within.
Unfortunately, Mrs. Regan, Ms. Regan's time has expired. Mr. Dontramon.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank you all for being here today. Even though I would quite much rather you being in your offices doing work in the districts, I'm sure you got a big stack of things to be working on today. I do thank you for taking the time out to be with us today. I'll ask a few general questions first as we talk about personal health information, and maybe it's going to be a question that Chris is going to answer and one that Anne's going to answer as well. Do you feel you've gone above and beyond to minimize the risk to the personal health information system? So it's a very general question, you know, how you're doing with it, you know, maybe things that are not in the speaking notes. How's it really going, and are you working really hard to get the AG recommendations under control? So whichever one wants it.
Ms. Power?
Okay, thanks. Thank you for that. Are we working really hard to address the recommendations that the Auditor General has given us? Absolutely we are. We take it very seriously. As I mentioned in our opening remarks, we are very grateful for the depth of that audit. And many of them were not, in fact, I don't think any of them were surprises to us, because we knew and know that this has been a resource issue and a decision we've had to make on where we balance. We are very confident in the integrity of our systems. And I think if you look at the number of potential breaches and the fact that we've had none from external, we're extremely proud of that and work hard to ensure that that's the case. And because we have so many people who have legitimate access to our records internally, that's been a little bit more challenging. But now, you know, we're introducing additional software that's going to help us with that, and the diligence with which our staff monitor that, to be sure. And, you know, the integrity with which the vast, vast majority of our staff work and understand how important privacy is. So we're confident at Capital Health that we're working towards those gaps that have been identified, but that security is absolutely critical for us, and we understand, we get it.
Yeah. And, Dr. McGuire?
I totally agree with all of the comments that Chris has made. It's a very evolutionary kind of process to address all of these issues. They are critically important in our day-to-day work, and I think that everyone involved in healthcare has privacy and protection of information forefront in their minds. So, like Capital District, we appreciated the opportunity for the analysis of our system and the identification of the gaps that we needed to address, and we're well down the road doing that. It is a delicate balance as we go forward to weigh the resources needed versus the absolute requirement to meet all of the requirements in the upcoming legislation, et cetera. So not a day goes by that we're not making progress.
Out of the, we'll start with, Anne has the microphone on there, so 25 recommendations from the AG. So how many of them are in process, done, or about to be done?
I will ask Fern to answer that, and I think we know.
Ms. Smith?
Thank you very much. As Anne had mentioned in our opening statement, of those that, of the AG recommendation, currently we have 32% that are complete. But it's important to recognize is that there's another 24%+ that we are actively working on and hope to have those completed within the next 3 to 6 months. And we collaborate with our provincial partners and with the Department of Health in understanding of those that will take a little bit longer, that we need to approach that at a system level. And they're going to take a little bit more in planning, but there will be some aspects that will be difficult because of limitations to current technology. So again, working, we look forward to the merged services work that's ongoing, because that's going to open up some opportunities for more of a provincial look at our systems, look at assessments, and introduce best practices, standardization, and move us towards meeting the FIA legislation.
Out of that bunch of recommendations that are a little more troubling or are going to be taking a little longer to do, what kind of examples could you give us of the ones that are going to take a little more time beyond the 32 that are almost complete, the 24 you're working on? What's the other gang of recommendations that are going to be a little harder to do? Give us an example, just a few examples, not all
of them. Certainly. A couple that come to mind, and one would be We're pleased that the province has purchased the fair warning software that Capital District Health has referred to using, and that tool will allow us for any of our information systems that currently have the ability to produce audit logs. So they allow us to know at a granular level what people are accessing. And those audit logs are what we're going to be able to use of those systems, move that into fair warning, which will then allow us to start to do some more in-depth, proactive auditing. If we've got some legacy systems or systems that do not produce those audits, then that's going to create some difficulty. And that's what I was referring to is prioritizing those systems, working with our colleagues to see, okay, what are the systems? Are there other systems in the province that could be replaced? And if there isn't any, then that's what I'm going to refer to. They're going to be a little bit more difficult because then they're going to require both financial and human resource investments. So those are the ones that are going to be a little bit harder. The other one is going to be the ability within the FEA legislation, which is what they call consent directives, or what you and I may know as that ability for families or patients to lock a piece of information. Mm-hmm. Our current technology does not allow that to happen. So what we need to do is look at mitigation strategies. And so that if we do get a request for that, it's going to be working with that patient or that family to understand the risk associated with that, and then work with them in order to protect that information or their concern as best as we can in a partnership with the clinical care provider and that patient or family. So that's just a couple.
Okay. I'm going to ask the same question to Capital Health there. I know it's pretty general, but there you go.
Ms. Power?
Thank you for that. I'm going to ask Shauna McMahon to address that for us.
Thank you.
Ms. McMahon?
Thanks. In the recommendations we had, we looked at, and I mentioned previously, some of them are similar themes. So there's a number of them related to the help desk. So that particular project got underway very quickly with our colleagues at HITS. We have an application purchased, we have a project team set up, and they are now working through the steps that they have to do, looking at the recommendations and building what the procedures will be for this new service desk system that will serve the province. Related to our data storage for Capital Health, we're 90% complete on that in terms of we have almost 300 servers, which are your small, mini, powerful computers that are being replicated at Yonge Street. HITS has probably the same number that we're replicating at the Abbey J. Lane. That's 90% complete for those two organizations, and we're also doing it provincially, so there's, I think that's about 75% complete. Those two are very complex projects, so we expect the storage we will finish up this year rather in short order, but we know it's a longer process for us because we need to look at, then we'll look at our processing and what we need to do with that. So depending on the complexity of the project, we're they take longer, so we may be, and we've been at them longer, we're farther along. Some of the other ones we're going through just in our day-to-day work, so making sure that our applications all have consistent password logo time, those sorts of things. So I would say it's different. All of them are in progress.
Okay, so out of the 33 recommendations I think Capital Health had, they're pretty much all being worked on in one way or another along the way. Talking about disaster recovery, I mean, you're talking about the servers in the two locations, Abbey Lane and, of course, Yonge Street. They're all in Halifax. So if the grid in Halifax goes down, where else is this being replicated?
Our servers, yes, up Yonge Street and then at the Abbey J. Lane. But we do have, at Capital Health, we do have some vendors that do some backup of data for us. We back up daily, weekly, monthly. We do two backups a day, and and we also have some tapes that we store off-site with confidential storage. So we try to make sure that we've covered that off. Maybe Mark might have some comments there.
Mr. LeBlanc?
Yes, thank you. As mentioned, they do do replication of data at both of the data centers for online storage, and then that's backed up to tape, which is then stored off-site at different... That is the data portion of which is the most important part in terms of getting the information and keeping the information. I think your question, though, relates to is if a disaster happens...
A little bit of both, so, yeah.
You're right. They are both within the peninsula of Halifax. They are on different electrical grids, mind you, and there are significant backup systems at both centres. However, with the province, we are looking at a secondary data center for all of the provincial initiatives, both in health and in government, outside of the peninsula. So there is an RFP going to be going out to look at providing a secondary data center, we're calling it, somewhere else in Nova Scotia at this point for that kind of online, very near availability, high availability data centers.
What kind of distance from the city would that be? Was it... you know, is it in the Truro Bridgewater radius, or if it's, or yeah, is it, you know, is it Sydney? I mean, that's
the high availability that we want to get for our data centers. The technology right now limits us into about a 100-mile area. So yeah, you're talking Truro a little bit further, somewhere in that radius.
Sort of the issue of data center, you know. You know, as we continue to add programming to it, whether it's PACS or others, I mean, we're getting into tremendous sizes of storage. You know, what kind of storage are we running right now in our data centers or in our? It's getting to be bonkers, I'm going to guess, but
Yes, we're into the petabytes of storage. We're way beyond gigabytes and all that. We're well into probably 500 petabytes of storage. If you include both the Capital Health and the Yonge Street, because they're both very critical to our systems. So, yes, the storage, and it keeps increasing. For example, on the PAC side alone, we're probably buying 35 to 40 terabytes of storage every year to manage the increase in volume that we're putting in there because of newer technologies. Your CT scan now takes huge amounts of data that it never took before. So every time you do a CT scan, it increases your storage. So it's increasing all the time, and it is a struggle to keep up with that, both in physical storage and the money to pay for that too.
As we continue to, I mean, we're talking about the connections and stuff in each of your districts and maybe in some of the connections between the two districts. How is that going? I know that right now IWK is doing some women's health work at the IWK. Maybe some scans are happening over at Capital Health. So I'm just wondering, how is the data flowing between the two organizations at this point? And then maybe I'll open the next question up to how's the data flowing into the other districts across the province?
Dr. McGuire.
For the record, Mr. Chair, it's not Dr. McGuire.
Oh, sorry about
but
that.
But
that's
thank
what
you.
We have here.
I'm very
sorry
flattered.
About that.
That is an issue that we are constantly working at, and not only between Capital District and the IWK is there significant collaboration, but I think as Fern mentioned, through merged services, et cetera, and there are a whole lot of initiatives where we're looking at improving the our ability to collaborate with information, et cetera. But I will defer to, I think, Fern to talk a little bit about some of the specifics of that.
Ms. Smith?
Our information system within the IWK, our main system is Meditech, and we are on a MAGIC platform, as previously noted. When we have those systems that, and we need to collaborate between, we are using the provincial's SHARE, so that's the Secure Health Access Record project. That will allow our physicians and our clinical care providers to have access to the information at a fairly high level. As well as that is that we are working between the two facilities so that physicians can have, Capital Health physicians can have access within the IWK to Capital Health data, and we can also have the application for Meditech so that the physicians at Capital Health can access Meditech at the same time. And again, we are looking forward to the merged services. Again, that is quite an opportunity, and we're quite excited about it, to look at it from a provincial perspective in regards to what is strategy and vision of all of Nova Scotia, so that everyone has access to that information in a timely manner.
Can I go over there? Good.
Answered that quite well. And
Ms. McMahon?
Sorry. We are looking forward. One of the things that we're looking at now, I mentioned before about scanning, and we've been doing that for since 2005 at Capital Health. Our next foray into technology is now working with the provincial colleagues to look at what we would call our next level EMR component. And currently, we don't have all of our scanned information available in that portal, but our EMR component would enable the healthcare providers to actually enter their work directly in the computer. They would have order entry online, and that would automate all of that work. So hopefully, my dream would be we would not have to scan the 34,000 sheets of paper every day. That is the ultimate goal. So, but we have worked very well with the SHARE portal over the last number of years to make sure that the clinicians can access that and get information they need. So they can get all the transcribed reports and view that and some other information. So that's come a long way to help them. And they all have access into the X-ray Web 1000, and they can view X-rays and other diagnostic results.
Ms. Power?
I'd be remiss if I didn't say that where we spend the vast majority of our money is in our hospitals. Where the vast majority of healthcare takes place is in our communities. And one of the issues that has been a bone of contention, certainly for our family physicians and people who practice in the community, is the connectivity to understand what happens with their patients when they come in. So, you know, we're just starting to launch into thinking about and working on an electronic medical record that will connect with not only within our organizations but in the community, and it is an essential component of being able to have health records move back and forth for citizens and patients' sake. So that's work that's certainly ahead of us. But when you talk about connectivity between hospitals, that's hugely important. But what is just as important is our connectivity in the community.
Well, thank you for leading me into my next sort of set of questions.
I read your mind.
You know exactly where I was going here. You know, because, I mean, sitting down at a number of conferences over the last 10 years, and we talked about EMR, and of course, connectivity as general, is that, you know, me in Yarmouth getting an X-ray is okay now because PACS will transfer that. But my medical record doesn't necessarily end up in the city the way it should from the Yarmouth. And the same thing happens that should one of us be in Vancouver and something happen to us, what's your fax number? I'll ship some of that over to you, hopefully. You know, again, Canada doesn't have that across Canada programming that allows us to share a medical record easily. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the challenge. But, you know, just getting us on University Avenue, being able to talk to each other, and then hopefully from University Avenue we can go into Peninsular Halifax, and from Peninsular Halifax we can go to HRM and continue on that route. You know, as much as these recommendations are good, and I think they show that, you know, you've got a lot of work to do internally, you know, I hope that it doesn't deter anyone from looking at those larger issues of providing a true emergency medical record across the province. And again, it's a general question, but, you know, some thoughts around that.
Yeah, well, perhaps I'll start. Anybody else can jump in. But to say that that is absolutely part of the vision for our electronic platform for the province. And, you know, we've known this for a long time. And it's, I think Ann mentioned it, it's a balancing act for not only the province, but for each of us of, you know, where we put the limited resources we have. But there, you know, there is a plan that's in place. And we're a little bit behind the schedule of where we hoped we would be at this point in time. But certainly a plan to have a health an electronic system for Nova Scotia. Now, you know, the rest of the country, we all came at this doing our own thing rather than looking at it from a system approach, and we're kind of running to catch up, and all provinces are doing the same thing, but we do have a plan here, and we're marching towards it.
Thank
Order,
you.
Order, please. Unfortunately, Mr. Dantamont's time has expired. Mr. Ramey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming this morning. I have to say, just before I begin, that my family has been a consumer of your services, both Capital Health and the IWK, and I can assure you that they got the absolute most stellar treatment when they were there, so I want to thank you for that. I was listening with interest. I think it was Ms. Galton was speaking about the development of software for the healthcare system, and I think ATMs or something were referenced at one point. It was somebody over there anyway who was speaking about this, and how they were first looked on in some kind of strange way, and now most people don't even carry cash because they have plastic and go to an ATM and get money if they need it. I'm just wondering in terms of the... this would be both IWK and Capital Health. In putting those systems together that you're using, I mean, you had to start somewhere. I know Johnny Cash wrote a song once called One Piece at a Time about building a car. And perhaps back in the day, systems weren't integrated or maybe had to buy from different companies and try to find some way to work it all together. But can somebody... either from Capital Health or IWK respond to that and tell me, let's say about 10 or 15 years ago, where you were and how you got where you are now. Could you just briefly tell me that? I know it's not a brief story, but give it a try.
Ms. McMahon.
Thanks. And it's a great question, and I could probably make it brief because I wasn't involved in the early days when all this came about. My understanding is that at the time, this would have been back in the 90s, that a group within the healthcare at that time, I do not believe that the Halifax Infirmary, VG, and some of those organizations were still separate at that time. Mm-hmm. But I do believe at the VG, in fact, I don't know that the new HI was even built, but the VG was meeting to bring in a system that would serve as an academic research and quaternary hospital. So it needed to meet a lot of needs. And at the time, there was very limited systems to select that would give the robust functionality. And it was very acceptable at that time. And I mentioned when I was speaking to Ms. Reagan before about the best of breed model we have, which means we take different vendor applications, connect them to what might be called the central brain, which is what our patient index registration system and write interfaces so they can all communicate together. So we have McKesson applications, we have Cerner applications, we have GE applications. So we connect those all together. IWK and our other DHAs have one platform called Meditech. None is right or wrong. It just in the context of the time and what was required and what was available, that's how Capital Health proceeded with its system. So we have now over, almost close to 300 applications that would run through that system. It is very complex, and as we move forward, we will re-examine that particular model and see what we can do. But at the time, that's how it evolved over the years, and it often comes from the fact that starting up, no one system would meet the needs of all of those right. disparate groups. So we went out and we picked what we thought would be the best to service our care providers. Now, the upside of that is that most of those systems have open architecture, so we are able to interface them. We are able to connect them very well. When you get maybe a one package system like Meditech, it's a little more challenging to do that. That would be my.
Ms. McGuire?
Just to give a little bit of context from the IWK point of view, and then I'm going to pass this over to Mark, who was there, well, maybe not quite at the beginning. Our Meditech Magic program was implemented, I would say, 25 in 89.
And at the time, it was a state-of-the-art system across North America.
Right.
And it has indeed served us extremely well. But we're now at the point where we really can't continue too far into the future to be able to maintain that system. And I think, as Sean and others have pointed out, it makes our system different from capital districts and makes both of us different from all of the other district health authorities that have a Meditech platform, but a different one. So I'll hand it over to Mark to talk a little bit about how effective that's been over the years, but then on the other hand, how it leaves us a little in a little precarious situation at the moment.
Mr. LeBlanc?
Yeah, the sharing of data has been the trickiest part of all of the hospital information systems that I've put in. As mentioned, the Meditech system was an integrated system, so internally within the system, it shared data very well, but you had to buy the whole package in order for that to happen. Mm-hmm. In the CDHA case, they had the best of breed. Within the lab system, it worked very well, but didn't share data with anyone else unless you built the integration to allow it to share data. So there was an awful lot of work that had to be done at the back end to make it work to share that data. So there was, it's just a choice that people had to make at the time. And today it's becoming more and more important to share data. As been mentioned, we need to get it to the patient, we need to get it to the doctors, we need to get it out there. So the systems now are becoming more and more integrated. They're getting away from these best-of-breed type systems, mostly in North America now. They're going to the integrated systems, which allows the hospital to have better data shared between itself, but also the systems now have moved ahead with the ability to share data with other integrated systems. So we can do that. In Nova Scotia, what we did to mitigate that problem is we built the share portal, which allowed certain amount of data to be shared between the three medical systems. So you can get lab work done in Truro, and someone in CDHA can look up that lab work. So that's a huge improvement to what it was 5 years ago, where mm-hmm. that never happened. The patient was the carrier of the data. Now we're able to look up certain elements of the data. Not all elements, like Shauna said. Some of it's scanned. We can't get access to that to share that. Some of it is still not being put in electronically. You can't get access to that. So it is improving, but it's taking a lot of work to get there and a lot of money to get there.
Ms. McMahon?
And I might just add that...
Ms. McMahon, your mic's not on yet. That's all. Great, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Go ahead.
There is a federal agency called Canada Health InfoWay that also is doing some work that's helping improve the integration of systems, as Mark said. So now with the systems that are available, you can perhaps purchase from one vendor, and they're very integrated, which wasn't the case 20 years ago. So it's come a long way, and some of that Canada Health InfoWay is helping the provinces in terms of creating standards that would enable that connectivity, and as Mr. D'Entremont said, at some point be able to then have your health information available as you move, so it would be truly portable.
Which makes total sense to me as well. One of the advantages, I guess, of asking questions in the third person to ask is you get to listen to a lot, and then of course it prompts prompts more questions while you're listening. But I guess the second question I have, and it was prompted by something something I heard over there, is the IWK is a center for really for, I guess, Atlantic Canada as well. I mean, we have patients coming, children from other Atlantic Canadian provinces, and perhaps even from other jurisdictions as well. Are we able to interface, the IWK able to interface with hospitals in PEI, New Brunswick, and Newfoundland and places like that, or do we have glitches there?
Mr. LeBlanc? Mr. LeBlanc, get your mic on here in a second. Mr. LeBlanc?
There we go. Thank you. To answer your question, no. We are working towards that with Canada Health InfoWay and the Pan-Canadian strategies, but right now sharing of information beyond PACS information. We do share PACS electronic x-ray information between New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, PEI, but other health information right now is still in the paper form. We are not connected to those systems.
Ms. McGuire?
The provincial health ministers are, however, looking at this whole issue and the potential for partnerships to accomplish, and that is a very current topic of conversation, particularly between Nova Scotia and PEI, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some possibilities to move forward, and there's certainly an interest and a will to do that.
Ms. Power?
And I would just add to that, that Capital Health is the same as IWK in that we service the Atlantic provinces, and the people who are coming to us are probably some of the most critically ill people that we're right. taking. So it is a major issue for us in sharing of information. So we're delighted that conversations are happening to tighten that up.
Thank you. And I guess along that same line, I was wondering how, because I'm sure you folks, at least some of you and maybe all of you, get to meet your colleagues from other parts of the country, outside of Atlantic Canada as well. I'm just wondering, are we here in Nova Scotia, in relation to the issues we're talking about this morning, sort of in about the same position as most other provinces? I heard an allusion a while ago about other provinces in the country, but are we in the middle of the pack? Are we lagging way behind? Are we catching up? Are we maybe a bit ahead? Can somebody just comment ever so briefly on that?
Mr. LeBlanc?
We are not in a bad position when you compare us to the rest of the provinces in Canada. We're all sort of in different places, the way we've attacked things and the way we've done things. In fact, because Nova Scotia put the one Meditech system in for 34 hospitals around the province outside of Halifax, put us hugely ahead of some other provinces, even New Brunswick, for example, though they have eight different hospital information systems, seven of which are Meditech, one of them is not, they don't share any better because they are seven standalone instances of the same product. So that doesn't really help you. Ontario, while Ontario is just a huge amount of different hospital information systems, LHINs and things like that, other provinces have gone the merged services route, but they're still struggling with getting hospital information systems together so that one instance serves everybody. So they're working towards it. Everybody's working toward it. We're all sort of in a different place, but Nova Scotia is not lagging in that instance because of what we did with the Meditech system. And the way we've got our share portal now working for our three systems, it's made it much easier because we only have three systems to integrate, not the 7, 8, or 20, 30, or whatever they have in Ontario.
Ms. McMahon?
Thank you.
Okay.
Just waiting for the light. I would support Mark's comments in that we're actually, when we talk to some of our colleagues, they're actually perhaps in some ways envious of what we have here in Nova Scotia because we, in many of those provinces, they do have such separate systems. And I've even talked to health organizations in Ontario that are part of the same organization but have different hospitals, and those hospitals are not connected. At Capital Health, all of our systems connect across all of our facilities, so, and even those out in the community. So they can look in and see the scan documents. They can access the archive record, and we did that purposely to connect them all. So in some ways, we're farther ahead, and then in other ways, we might be behind, but we're certainly not the laggards in the country. That's for sure. I think we will, with our EMR work and some of the plans that we have in the future, we will really jump ahead of other provinces because we do have more integration happening.
Well, it's very very gratifying to hear that. And I have to say, if I have these percentages right, and I may have them wrong, but I was paying attention. I heard at one point that 32% of the recommendations were complete, I think, 24 maybe percent within 3 to 6 months, 16% within a year, and then that 12%. And I think Mr. D'Entremont asked a question already about the what's in that 12% and received an answer on that. But, I mean, that's pretty good. Sounds like you're moving it. You also said, at least twice I heard this, I think you were thanking the Auditor General, or you were praising the Auditor General. I don't know how he feels about that. He probably feels okay about it, I'm guessing, for doing this audit and the comprehensive nature of the audit, which I think you implied that it would have been very difficult for you to do internally, largely, I guess, perhaps based on financial considerations and so on. My question on this, and I'm rapidly running out of time, and I know my colleague from Halifax, Shabukta, is going to ask questions or some questions in the second round, but I'd like to get this one in. Is this the first time that, and I maybe do know the answer to this, but I'm not sure, that an audit of this kind has been done on your operations?
Ms. Power?
Well, we are the target of Auditor General's coming in and looking at us a lot, and so we should be because we're so large. So we spend lots of time with the Auditor General's office on a number of things. But for my recollection and in my time as CEO, this is the first time we've had such an in-depth look at our IT systems at Capitol Health.
Ms. McMahon?
That's correct. We do. We are an accredited facility, so we have, during accreditation, had just oversight review, I guess, of our systems. They were positive. When we do our financial audit, they do a controls audit on our IT system. The last one that was done was very positive. No report. This is the first time that I could find in any of the records of such an in-depth audit, and it was appreciated because, as it's been mentioned, we would never be able to do that without a significant cost. And I would like to point out that we are working through the recommendations while we continue to keep a complex organization running. And so we're working through that while we support our clinical care folks every day doing the work that they do. So it's been a very positive experience, and I do believe the auditor that we had at some points, they extended it a month because he said, this is a very complex place. I said, no. Good. Kidding. I just gave this morning some examples of the volumes that we do. So we are very, very, very busy. So it was a pleasure to actually read it and see that we do have some areas to tidy up. And it was nice to know that they weren't insurmountable, that we can do it. And we believe we will achieve that within the next year, year and a half.
Yes, Ms. McGuire?
Similarly for the IWK, I believe it was the first time that we have been engaged in an audit using these particular standards and with this degree of rigor. Mm-hmm. We do our own internal quality reviews constantly, but this took us to a whole new level and has certainly given us a whole new challenge and direction as we move forward in this area. So it has been very helpful.
Thank you. And again, I think my colleague from Argyle, Mr. Dontron, was asking some questions sort of around this general area. But I guess, you know, in this day and age, you know, being able to send things electronically, it's so smart and so fast and it works so well. And I know that would be a goal, you know, obviously to be able to do that, especially in a province like ours, which isn't too big, and also I guess from other jurisdictions, it would be ideal if it could be from other jurisdictions too. But so just to get a little bit of a clarification on that, where are we with being able to do that? Are we miles away from being able to do that, or are we approaching a time when it's not too far away?
Ms. McMahon?
Okay. Gosh, I'm coming to the mic even before I get acknowledged. Oh, yes, Chatty Cathy. I would say that we're getting very close to that reality. In fact, some days that I could sit at Capitol Health and I said, I joke a few days, I'll say I'm dizzy now. Within our just our network, we have it divided now. We use a Cisco network, and for our clinical folks, we have them set up so that all of the access that they have to clinical information would not interfere with what might be available to the public. And you mentioned about the
order,
prevalence.
Please. Unfortunately,
okay.
Mr. Ramey's time has expired. Ms. Regan, 14 minutes.
Thank you very much. There was something that someone said in response to, I think, Mr. D'Entremont about not being able to share information, computer information with family doctors yet.
Ms. Power?
Yeah. So just to clarify, our family physicians in the community, the vast majority of them have access to lab reports and to some of our scanned information, but a true electronic medical record where we're sharing back and forth. So they're getting information from us, but not vice versa. And so we want to have an integrated record that has everything about the patient on it. So we're a ways away from there.
So when... I thought I saw commercials that talked about electronic records, that Nova Scotia was moving to electronic records.
We are moving towards.
But they are not available yet. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Ms. McMahon?
I would describe it as we aren't 100% electronic, but as Mark and Fern and others have suggested, for example, there's an umbrella system called the Share Portal. And the Share Portal, all of our family physicians and others have access to that. There is information that goes in. It's like a viewing umbrella application, and they can go in and look at the medical reports that have been dictated. They can see the lab results. They can see the diagnostic imaging results. The piece that we're now working on, and I was alluding to before, is what's called clinical documentation, where the care provider is actually typing in the system, where now they're writing. So when I mentioned all the scanning we're doing, that's actually them writing all the information from the visit, comes down into a department, and we scan 34,000 sheets a day across our district alone. I'm not even speaking about the other 8 districts or the IWK. So what we're trying to do is now get that particular piece in place over the next few years that we would call it the EMR component, and it would have that clinical documentation and it would have the order entry component to it. Once we have that and we can then feed that into the Share Portal, that should provide that access for everyone in the province. But that will be a few years, and we're also working on that. As Chris Power mentioned, we're having conversations as a result of the ministers meeting with our other Atlantic provinces. We are all struggling right now in the same place with some applications, major applications for an EMR, and they are all very expensive. It wouldn't be unheard of to say the $10 to $20 million range to get those up to the level they need to be. So for small population base, we're now talking to those other provinces to see, is there something that we can do? So.
Thank you. So just to clarify, if I recall that commercial correctly, it shows someone coming into an ER and they're immediately accessing the person's records. But in fact, all that would be on there at that point would be records if they've previously been in the hospital or had tests, not if they're just Joe or Josephine Average, who goes to the doctor and has had no problems. Is that correct?
Mr. LeBlanc?
There is a lot of electronic information systems out there that are related to health in the province, and the commercial is probably related to more so a personal's health record being available. And there is a pilot project right now in the province where we're looking at a personal health record, and that would include your records from your doctor. that you would have access to, so that if you show up in an emergency room, you would be able to access not only the records of the hospital, or the doctor would look up your, in the share portal, the records in the hospital, you could yourself look up your own personal health information, or provide that information to look up to the doctor, and it would contain information from your own family physician or specialists that you have visited that were participating in this program. So there is a pilot project right now to look at all of the nuances, because there's a lot of issues dealing with this, and they're not technical in nature a lot of the time. They're all to do with sharing of information, privacy, confidentiality, and all those other things that we've been talking about. So these are very complex. And they're also not cheap to do, to give citizens access to their health information. And that would answer sort of Mr. Donchamon's question, as well as being able to have access to your own personal health information. And you choose who to share it with at that time, because you have the access. So most likely in an ER you would want to share it, but you may not want to share it with others of your health, in your health profession. So there's that section of it, which I think is what you were alluding to, more than what the hospitals are doing.
So the pilot project is underway. Where is that underway?
Right now it's in the Halifax area. There's in excess of, I think it's somewhere in the 30 physicians that have signed up, and hundreds of patients of theirs that they've gone to that have signed up for this program, and they're doing the pilot project now. I haven't got the exact numbers, but I can get them.
Thank you. Okay, so I'll have to go back and look at that commercial again, because I thought that things, everything, it was proceeding, it wasn't a pilot project, and everybody's records were being put online, and that's...
In a hospital, the records are online, yes, and they would have that. And our share portal allows us, like I said, you come from Truro, come into Halifax, and your hospital information would be available. But we need to expand that. So it's not there yet. So it might have been an Art of the Possible commercial. I don't know which one.
I'll have to get a hold of it. So on to the IWK. According to the AG, recommendation 3.12 requests that the IWK should better secure its system by increasing password and account controls, which include requiring users to use complex passwords, preventing users from using previous passwords, and locking accounts after a number of failed login attempts. The IWK responded by stating they agreed with this recommendation, which will require additional funding. So I'm just wondering, how much additional funding has the IWK estimated this would cost, and has the Department of Health and Wellness provided that required funding?
Mr. LeBlanc or Ms. McGuire, which one?
Me first.
Okay. Ms. McGuire?
We don't have specific information around the costing, and the whole issue around passwords, although it might seem simple at first glance, is really fairly complex, and I'll have probably Fern respond to all of that. We really have not formally asked for resources. We are working from our own internal resources and trying to reallocate those as is appropriate, but I think Fern can talk about the intricacies of passwords.
Ms. Smith?
Passwords. What needs to be appreciated within a healthcare system is that there are numerous health information systems that our clinical care providers need to access at any given point in time into the provision and delivery of healthcare to our patients. So in respecting that, we need to acknowledge that our clinicians would need to know, if we were to implement full, stronger passwords, which could be up to 12 characters, they could be alphanumeric, there would be a requirement in emergent, urgent times when we'd be looking at our physicians or clinicians to know how many different passwords. And what we want to do is ensure that those difficult passwords don't interrupt the provision of safe, quality patient care. So there's a delicate balance. We are looking at our systems. We will be looking at those and to see and assess them for where we could maybe increase our passwords, but where it may have a negative effect to patient care, we are not comfortable in going there. When we made the comment regarding requiring additional resources, that was in terms of looking at something which is called a single sign-on, which is a solution which would enable the clinicians to have one password. Therefore, it could be complex, and knowing that one password would get them immediately into a number of the information systems, therefore decreasing the risk for not accessing information at a critical point in time in delivery of patient care.
So it, just in terms of accessing patient records, are there sort of different levels of accessibility? So let's say if you're an LPN and you log on, can you get anybody's records, or is that restricted to, you know, a doctor, or how does that work?
Patient or staff's access to patient information within the systems is driven by the need for them to have access to do the role into which they've been hired to do. And if you happen to be a nurse and you need to provide nursing care, then you're going to have that access to all patients who could come through the door, because to do their role in nursing, they need that access to that information.
So if you were, let's say if you were a nurse on the neonatal unit, would you only have access to the patients who are on the neonatal unit, or would you have access to patients in orthopedic, in all the various parts of the hospital?
That will depend at the IWK on the role of that nursing position, if you will.
Yeah.
So we have some areas where we would have a float team.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a float team and you're the nurse on that float team, then you would need access to wherever the expectations of that float team would go.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends, again, on that role and where and who that provider is.
So generally, if you're not on the float team, if you work on in a certain unit, would you have access to only the records of the patients on that unit, or would it go beyond?
The access is given to the systems within the unit of the patients that they will see. And then again, it'll depend on other types of nursing if they have other roles that go beyond. So we do need to ensure that they have access. But again, when access is approved and given, there's a good understanding between the clinical care area and the manager who is approving access before access is given.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would that be the same case for Capital Health? Would nurses be restricted to their unit unless they had a more generic role throughout the hospital?
Ms. Galton?
Thank you. Realizing our patients move between units all the time, and so that would be very difficult to do. The concept of a nurse tied to a list of patient names is not a current capability and not easily achieved simply because of that. So, you know, the nurse in eMERG needs to know, the nurse in orthopedics needs to know. If there's a critical orthopedic patient and one needs to move to the medicine unit, then the medicine nurse needs to know. So the level there is, as Fern indicates, a huge level of understanding at the front end what it means to have access, and the principle of need to know, and that will go through everything, is what is fundamental to what you then actually access. So
just to make sure that I understand what you're saying is, if you are a nurse at the infirmary and you're on a unit, you have access to the records of all the patients at the hospital. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. McMahon?
Yeah. I would like to add, though, that as others have mentioned in terms of need to know, we do have within the setup of access, people do have to fill in a request form. It's a user ID request form. It has to be signed by their most senior supervisor. And we do, for example, if for people that are direct care providers, they do get access to specific systems, and it is to all the patients because they are moving all the time. And the staff move as well.
Order, please. Unfortunately, Ms. Regan's time has expired. Mr. Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the
witness committee today for being with us, and I look forward to an opportunity to ask a few questions. And I want to focus a little bit on the backup stuff that Chris was talking about a little while ago, and I guess he just touched on it a little bit. But when I think about the backup systems, I think about where I used to work. I used to work in the Provincial Ambulance Communication Center, and every day we would take 350 calls. Today they're taking 450 to 500 calls or so, and every day the system is backed up. It's all technology, it's all electronic, and I think about how easy that was. It doesn't sound easy, but it's, you know, it's technical, but it's a pretty simple process. The calls come in, they get recorded, everything's recorded, and it wouldn't matter if it was a call or you were entering data. You know, it's all there, it's all recorded, and it would be backed up every night, you know, once in 24 hours or twice, whatever the routine is, and then that would be stored. It didn't seem like that big a deal, and I think I heard earlier, I gathered, that there were multiple backups. Is that correct? I just want to clarify the point, so if somebody wants to take that, that would be great.
Mr. LeBlanc?
Yes, there are multiple backups taken now. The storage system itself does backups within the storage system of itself for preventing failure of electronic components within the storage. Then that data is replicated to the other data center in full, which then also copies that into its sections of itself. So there's at least three, possibly four copies. And then there are tape backups that are made as well of certain data. So there are lots, data is well backed up and well protected.
Okay, and I want to be clear. I am not that technical. You know, I understand the basics of that, and I understand exactly what you're saying. So there sounds like there's lots of copies of things, and I understand the tape backup that you're referring to as well, and it's stored safely and whatever. But does it all end up in the same place, though? So all of these multiple backups that are done coming from whatever the systems are, does it all end up in the same house, shall we say?
Not necessarily. Like I said, the Yonge Street data center data, primary data for the Meditech system for 34 hospitals, is backed up at the CDHA center. So that data is there. Their data gets backed up to the Yonge Street. So you've got two different systems right there. And then other offsites are dependent on the hospital. I think Capital Health put someone in a secure storage area offsite. So we do it at different locations as well. So it's not all ending up at one location. There are multiple copies exist in multiple locations.
Is there a goal somewhere along the way here that there would be one house, if you will, again, for all of the data to end up from, you know, the IWK or wherever the location, the hospital, and all of these other systems might be? It would seem a bit of a, I don't want to call it a scattered mess, but a bit of a scattered plan that we currently have. And I realize you have multiple copies, which is somewhat concerning, probably at the same time from an auditor's perspective. And just when I was trying to track it down, does that mean that there are multiple places to go and access it as well?
No, the backup copies of the data are electronically done in such a way that they have to be accessed by the system that they were made for. You can't just go in and look at that data from any terminal or anything like that. It's meant to work with the system. No, you don't have to concern about that. Our ultimate goal is to have our secondary data site as a high availability data site, which means that you will have two data centers working in conjunction with each other and have access to the data in either site at any time. One site could completely disappear off the grid and you wouldn't even know it. You would still be able to do your work based on the secondary data center. So that's our ultimate goal to have. And then that way you are protected at all times. And you would still do internal copies of the data in each site for the purposes of a disk drive going bad or a computer going bad, but it would give you your replication of the data that you wanted.
Thank you. And just a little bit more on the backup sites while I'm on it. I think about, again, I'll use the example where I came from and what we did. Now, the backup site was not really close to where we were. It was a significant distance, and I won't state where that is for obvious reasons. But it sounds like that the backup that you're currently holding is relatively close to the actual location, and that would be a concern, obviously, in and of itself. Is there a plan to move that? And if so, how far would you say is a reasonable distance?
There is a plan with our secondary data center. That's what we're looking for, is off the peninsula. Technology limits that now to a sort of 100-mile radius to be a high availability. If you want to do strictly data storage and you get it when you need it, you can store that anywhere in the world. But for high availability, we're into the 100-mile, which puts it, I think, within any kind of standard, well within any kind of standard that's out there now for secondary sites.
I heard Someone mentioned the number of pages a day. Can somebody clarify what that was again? I'm just not sure that I heard that right.
Ms. McMahon?
That we are going through in the system?
Yes, and I think your point is interesting when you talk about your system, and I think if I'm understanding correctly, you would have one system running for all of the EMTs, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, and so when Mark and I are speaking, I mentioned at Capital Health, we have almost 300 applications. So when we're doing backup, we're trying to make sure that we are storing and backing up based on how critical we need to recover. And right now, as Mark mentioned, because of the need to have the redundancy, we do keep things in different places. One application we have is called Horizon Patient Folder. That has eliminated Capital Health from creating paper charts since around 2005, 2006. All the documents that are written on when you arrive for a visit within any of our facilities is sent to health information and gets scanned and indexed to the patient's record, and then we no longer keep the paper. And I mentioned we do 34,000 sheets a day, a million a month. So it's a lot of paper.
That's what I thought you said, and I was actually going to ask. You've sort of answered what I was just going to ask. What do you do with all that paper?
We keep it for a short period of time, and then we do destroy that because we do back up the electronic information. And so that's how we manage that.
Thank you. And as I said, I was just kind of curious as to, that's a lot of paper. How much storage area do we have around with all of the stuff in it, assuming that you probably did move to the scanning option and filing accordingly, which is great. But
yeah, and I would remind folks that those papers coming down were being filed by hand. So the technology has really, and we would staff, we would have a huge number of people every night trying to file, and they couldn't get it on the chart fast enough because the charts weren't keeping up with the paper going. So now we scan those documents every day within 24 hours. They are done, uploaded, and available to the care provider. So it's pretty fast for their availability. We do store it with Iron Mountain, and then we do have a confidential destruction policy with those.
Thank you for that. And I'm just kind of curious as well, as the technical folks, and as you work toward, you know, tomorrow and long after that, and what the leading edge of technology changes so quickly, even in medicine, as we know. Is there a point where you ever see that you're off of paper and, you know, the nurse is standing in the room and they go bang on that computer screen that's already up there doing their thing? And, you know, I'm quite familiar with the setting, so that says, I just did this or I just did that. I know we're using it, and I'll reference again, the paramedics in the streets are using the tablets, of course, and, you know, there was a reason for that. And albeit you got 300 systems, we're dealing with one. It may not be a great analysis, but it is similar in nature. So
we are doing that now. We do have some pilots running where we have physicians using iPads, and they're using wireless. And we use a technology that they can access their clinical systems now on those devices. And earlier we discussed that we are working on implementing the clinical documentation that would be done right at the point of care. So we would hopefully, my dream would be eliminate all that scanning and those that paper.
Obviously, there's a bit of a cost associated with that. That's one of the reasons. And when we're looking at tightening budgets and trying to reduce the figures, I would see that as one of those areas probably of
yes, and we factor that into the to the business case. Even with the scanning, we had a return on investment at Capital Health over 3.5 years on that application. It was, I think, if my memory's correct, about $3 million. And by doing that work, we eliminate all the paper charts that you would have. And we did, over time, we reduced the staff, obviously, because we can do it much faster.
Thank you for that. I want to talk a bit about the data in general now, and we've had before us in this committee in the past folks here, maybe the deputy at the time was talking about the issues of access and passwords, and there were a lot of problems for a while there about who could access patient information and things like that. I know in my area there were a couple of calls from families who were involved in that, and to say they felt violated was putting it quite mildly. You may recall some of that, but what's been done since then to try to tighten the system up and who can access? I know that if you were a ward clerk, and I'll just use some examples here, you couldn't access patient records, or if you were a clerk, you could only go so far, and, you know, then that was the next step, and perhaps the doctor had all the authority. Where is this right now? How is this working? Has there been changes made to that way this works?
So it's an interesting division between what you can achieve electronically in that situation versus what is a matter of trust in accessing records. And in these instances, we need healthcare providers to have huge access to patient information. They need it for quality care. They need it for safe care. And so, as folks have indicated, at the front end, we're very careful about who gets access to what. But sometimes, even in situations where people are allowed access, they need it to do their jobs, you can, of course, have, and they're very rare, have situations where that is not the case, and where we've seen some problems arise. So on that front, we absolutely look at what we can do from an auditing perspective to both reactively audit as we get complaints and proactively audit to identify that. Those are huge ways to be teaching our people about how important it is. And we work all the time around increasing education on this front. So one of the things, there are loads of things, but one of the things at Capital Health is now a mandatory re-education program on the fundamental importance of confidentiality, and in fact a re-signaturing, if that's a word, it's not, off the confidentiality pledge. And that pledge is very, very front and center. FIA and its introduction actually provides us with a great platform. We have to educate on it in any event, and to really start to hammer home this, the confidentiality, as such a fundamental issue, it provides us with that additional forum to have those discussions.
Thank you. How much time do I have, Mr. Chair?
You have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Thanks. I don't have a lot of time, but I'll just say thank you for that. I was kind of curious, and the auditing piece is one thing, and I think that we have to constantly be doing that. I also understand sometimes you just can't control what people do either. But I was curious about, how can I break it down, maybe the access piece. You know, front page, you can have access if you're there's 2-3 pages, and you can have access if you're that. There's different levels, and I think that was sort of what people understand, everyday people understand. How do you get to a certain thing, especially when you're passworded, it's technology. I mean, it's a matter of writing a program, I assume. Again, I'm not technical by any means, but, you know, people wonder how you get that deep into it and how they could possibly know so much or go so deep into something whereby certain levels of people just shouldn't have that access. And, you know, that was a pretty serious issue. I guess I can't stress that enough. And I'm sure people are still wondering, you know, what's been done. And I think that, to your point, you know, that's good that we're doing more. And I think it's ever, there's always more we can do by way of education and everything else to go along with that. So I don't know if anyone else wanted to comment. I know we're running down on time, but I'll finish. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mrs. McMahon, and you only have about 40 seconds.
Okay, I will make a comment, and this relates to when I was cut off with Ms. Reagan. We don't give carte blanche access for everyone. We do have tiers. So if you are in the direct care, you would be rated as tier one. You would get broader access. So your clerks, we actually segregate the types of documents they can look at. It's not across the board. We do. We have a general approach to that, but there are some cases where, because of the work that someone's doing, they may have it broader, but we can segregate the documents they look at. If someone is approved for research, they come in, we actually will, there's a quite a process
order,
they go
order,
through
please,
for ethics.
Unfortunately, you've run out of time.
Thank you.
Mr. Epstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for being here. This has been quite interesting. I just want to ask a few odds and ends of questions. I'd like to start actually with something about the extent to which the records are now electronic. I think we heard that there's a lot of generation of records electronically, and then I assume a form of conversion or scanning that would take place. So the first thing I wondered whether was whether there are some documents that are not suitable for conversion to an electronic basis. I wonder, for example, about handwritten notes, or are there certain kinds of X-rays or other forms of diagnostic imaging that might not be electronic? I'm not sure, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about that first.
Ms. McMahon?
I'll finish up with that very quickly. We have our diagnostic imaging and lab. That information is, I talked before about interfaces, that information actually gets sent electronically to that Horizon patient folder. So it all gets archived as the complete record in that system. All the documents that are handwritten are scanned. So that's why we have 34,000 a day. Okay. So everything is scanned and put into what we call Horizon patient folder. That's basically the same as the old paper chart you had years ago. It's all in that system now.
Okay.
So all available to view.
Thank you. And when did the system at Capital Health become all electronic?
That system went in 2005, and it took us a couple of years to pull it across the district. Again, the lab system, those were in place beforehand. Diagnostic imaging was in place beforehand, as was our pharmacy system.
Yes.
But they do interface with that HPF and create a
complete. And what's the situation with old records, pre-2005 records?
Oh, that opens up a good topic. It's one of my bees in my bonnet. In the act that we have here in Nova Scotia, we keep medical records for 25 years. It was 20 for a while, and it went to 25 because of the food and drug and requirements when it was a research record. I would add that many provinces have gone to a 10 or 15-year retention because it's very costly, and I did a survey around international basis, and 10 to 15 years is kind of the norm, and at one point before my job changed, it was one of the things that I had hoped that we might talk about as a province, what is our retention period, but right now it's 25 years, and that's in our I think it's 20 years in the Health Act, 25 years at Capital Health because of the research component.
Right. So there's been no attempt to go back and make electronic the pre-2005 records, except those that already were.
We have almost 2 million charts. You can't make them electronic because the electronic works, the form, you have to barcode it all, and that barcode is read in the scanner, and that's what indexes it to the right person's chart. There's actually two codes on it. One barcode is the patient's when they come in, and the bottom one says that's a nursing progress note, and that's how it gets indexed. So if I was to pull up a chart, I would be able to see there's 70 document types. So as a clinician, I can go and say, I want to look at the progress note for the last visit. I want to go see the ambulatory care visit. I want to go see this. So that's how they would find it quickly.
Yes. Okay. Are these records searchable? By which I mean, we've talked a lot about the security aspect, but if for statistical purposes you needed to pull out information, are they all searchable? I see, for example, just to focus on the IWK, stats from time to time about numbers of children that are injured in certain kinds of accidents. And so these stats must come from somewhere, and I'm assuming that unless someone is just keeping an eye on them as they float by, that they're probably searchable. So is that the case?
Ms. Smith?
That data that you're referring to is actually coded and abstracted, if you will, from another department. And that department uses the International Classification of Diseases, or it's well known as ICD-10. And so coding and abstracting is going on across the country for 25 plus years. So those statistics that we're able to mine that data and provide that is available through another means. The scanning and archiving component, which Capital District Health Authority had implemented several years ago, is also now a provincial initiative for the IWK and the other district health authorities. And the IWK has just actually within about, I'd say, February, have moved forward with actually scanning our paper documents into our electronic medical record. It's a different system than Capital Health, but again, that is where our files are able to be scanned so that they are then accessible to clinical care providers who have been previously authorized to have such access.
Okay. All right. Can I ask something about the share portal? As I understood it, this is something that would allow family physicians to have some access to the hospital records. And did I also understand that the hope would be that there would be some mutual sharing so that the hospital might also have access to family physician records? Is that the basic idea?
Mr. LeBlanc?
Right now, you're correct in that physicians who sign up to view the share portal have access to certain data that's from the hospital information system, lab data, DI data, and some electronic reports. Eventually, we would like to have the general practitioner and specialist data to be able to be accessed as well, but right now it is not.
I know our focus is on the hospitals, I heard you mention earlier that there are some pilot projects yes. underway. Can you just tell us to what extent family physicians in Nova Scotia actually are using electronic records right now in their own offices?
There's greater than 50% that are using electronic records. I haven't got the exact numbers, but I can get them. But there's greater than 50% of family physicians and specialists using electronic medical records in their own practices.
Okay, fine. And actually, I think I cut you off a moment ago. Did you want to finish on your point about the sharing?
No, just that we hope that we'll get there someday, that we have it all available.
Okay, thank you. I was just conscious of time. Yeah. Can I ask about something about the nature of the breaches of security that might have taken place over the last number of years? And I know people are naturally enough very sensitive about their own personal information getting out there, and yet at the same time, so far as I'm aware, most of the instances that I can recall having ever heard of sounded as if they were more along the lines of people being nosy about their friends, neighbors, and relatives, maybe curious about a celebrity if someone showed up who was well known. Is that really the nature of the breaches, or has there been something else? And I ask because of this. We've had a very famous case in Halifax of a breach of military security where we now have a Mr. Delisle serving time in jail for selling secrets to a foreign power. I mean, is there something marketable? I mean, I assume there is something marketable in the health information, but have we run into this, or have other jurisdictions in Canada, or is it mostly of the nature of personal nosiness?
I'll ask some of my other colleagues, I think, to respond to that question.
Ms. Galton?
So, we, in fact, the notorious cases that we hear about are not electronic access, and those someone who's tapping into the records electronically from their computer at home or any of those types of things. As we indicated, you know, we monitor for that risk, but it's not the breach. It's not the breach that you hear about in healthcare. It's interesting. I'm a lawyer, but if you participate in things that dealing with the confidentiality of health information these days, they actually do start to discuss that as a significant risk, and yet we don't see it as having materialized because of the systems we have in place. So we are largely looking at situations where someone appropriately has access and then there is a use of that was not on a need-to-know basis.
Yes, but that gets back to my question. In terms of incidents that have actually occurred in Nova Scotia, has it essentially been hospital personnel satisfying their personal curiosity about someone else? Is that really what we're looking at?
So I won't speak to the motivation of people on that front, but those are the ones we hear about, are instances where there's been a person who's accessing as opposed to an electronic failure of security.
And have there been sort of larger breaches of security or attempts that have been rebuffed?
Ms. McMahon?
I think in your kit we provided you from Capital Health's perspective. We use a multi-layered approach for security for the IT systems. And that would start with HITS is the umbrella. It's a private network, so they have their firewall and they have security in place. At Capital Health, we also contract with an external company, and they just sit and run a program on our system constantly to tell us what threats are happening. In a 12-month period, we had 1 million attempts Of those over that year, 20 were escalated, none breached the system, but they were escalated to the point where our security went in and actually did some work to make sure that they didn't get any further. So we have a multi-layered approach. We also have encryption on our laptops. We also have a system called, we refer to it as NAC, and basically what that is if someone comes in with a home router or something that's not authorized and they plug it into our system, it blocks it and shuts it down. It actually tells us right where they are.
Yes.
So Catherine's speaking about people that have access legitimately,
yes,
and then perhaps extend what they believe that access granted them.
And that was really what seems to me to be the typical case, but you're not telling us about possible attempts from some external actor to access the system,
yes,
generally. Do we know anything about why any entity would do that?
I would say any company today that has technology has that happening all the time. Hackers just sit there and try to fish through. Banks would have the same setup. Hospitals all have it. Your departments here have it, and I'm sure the auditor has it.
So they're the target, I assume, would not probably be so much the health information as things like names, address, date of birth, and maybe telephone number or something like that.
Fishing to see what they'd hit. Who knows?
Yes.
We target that. I would speak in terms of previous role. When I managed health information services, I know over a 6-7 year period, I had one employee breach that I investigated. So I would suggest, based on the volume, that we have 12,000 employees, the amount, it is very infrequent, and I would say our care providers take their work very seriously. And even I've had calls from care providers that said, I think I hit something incorrectly and I don't want anyone to audit me and I'm really sorry and this is what I did. So it would be very unusual, and I think when we refer to some of those media stories, they get that attention because it doesn't happen that often.
I agree, and thank you very much. That's a big help. Thanks for your presentation today.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. I will now give the two organizations a chance to sort of wrap up, and I'll start with Ms. McGuire.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think, as you can see by all of the comments, questions, and answers today, that our commitment to protecting personal health information of each and every patient at the IWK is a very strong one, and we take our role as custodians of this information very, very seriously. We do look forward to enhancing our existing security protocols as we make continued progress on implementation of the Auditor General's recommendations. And we look forward to harnessing opportunities for system-wide enhancements through initiatives like Merge Services Nova Scotia and FIA. And patients and families, in particular, should be assured that their information is securely managed by the IWK. We'd like to thank all of you for the opportunity to discuss this very important topic with you today. Thank you.
Ms. Power.
Thank you. Well, I too would like to thank all of you. We always welcome an opportunity to be able to talk about what we're doing at Capitol Health and hold ourselves highly accountable to each other, but particularly to you and to the citizens we serve. So when there are any indications that we're not living up to the standard that we hold ourselves to, we always welcome an opportunity to see that, to do better, and to speak to you about that. So thank you for the opportunity. This is a hugely important area for us, and I know that it's a hugely important area to our citizens to know that we hold their information very closely to our chest and use it only in times when we need to provide care to them. So thanks very much.
I'd like to thank you very much for coming today. It was very interesting and very informative, and you do have a difficult job on your hands. There was a couple of requests sort of through the system. Ms. Kelly had asked for pilot project numbers, and the clerk will send detailed information. And Mr. Epstein also asked about the number of physicians using electronic data in their office. If you could provide that, that would be great. Again, I'd like to thank you for coming today, and look forward to many improved things from the department as you move forward with this very complex issue. That
concludes our meeting for today. We will have our next meeting next week. It will be the public trustee's office. And this before, after we adjourn, we're going to have a presentation by the Auditor General for the committee members only. So again, I'd like to thank you for coming, and a motion to adjourn be in order. So thank you very much for the motion to adjourn. We stand adjourned.